Hello, and welcome to the Muslim Sheroes of Minnesota podcast, where we spotlight the Muslim women of the Minnesota community. My name is Nosheena Hussain, and I'm the executive director of RISE, Reviving the Islamic Sisterhood for Empowerment. Our mission is to amplify the voice and power of Muslim women through storytelling, leadership development, and civic engagement. What is a shiro? A shiro is a female trailblazer who is creating change in her community. She takes risks, she challenges misconceptions, and addresses injustices. Shiros are on a mission to build a better world, and the sisterhood is here to support them and lift their voices.
We are joined today by Sister Fariel Khan.
It's a pleasure, Nosheena. Thank you for having me.
So we want to know a little bit about you. What's your background? Where'd you grow up? And how'd you end up in Minnesota?
So I was born in Pakistan, and I think I was about maybe 9 when I came here straight to Minnesota. We had family here, and we heard that the education system was really good because that's what my dad wanted for my 2 brothers and I, to have a pretty good education. Like, you're well off in Pakistan, you know, good middle-class family, if you want to put it like that. But he knew that there would be definitely, you know, the phase of glass ceiling. You can't really see it, but can't really progress, especially for women. But I feel like back home, it's like a brick ceiling because you can see it. It's not, you know. Yeah. So I think he knew, and he just wanted us to have a better opportunities. So we just sort of moved to Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and stayed there for years.
Okay. Where'd you go to school? Like college?
I went to school in Eden Prairie High School. So that was over there in Southwest suburbs. And then I went to U of M. I wanted to go to Northwestern, but my dad was like, no, let's stick to U of M.
Yeah.
So I did my undergrad in psychology, BA, and a double minor in family violence prevention and family social science. And then I'm starting grad school in marriage family therapy, hopefully with an emphasis in sex therapy.
Interesting. So what keeps you busy during the day?
I'm a mother of a 2-year-old, so obviously being a mother of a toddler with tantrums keeps me busy. But I work as an emergency assistance coordinator at the Building Blocks of Islam. So we're a nonprofit organization, and I oversee the department where we provide financial assistance to both non-Muslims and Muslims.
I didn't know there was Muslims in need. Like, paint the picture there. What's it like?
We have this mentality that there are no Muslims in need in America because money may be growing from trees, but there are many Muslims that are in need of financial assistance, rental help, all these different things, food help. I mean, 1 in 10 Minnesotans, I believe that's the statistics, that's going to bed hungry. Mm-hmm. And the Muslims are not immune from it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our clients are Muslims and non-Muslims too, but 60-70% of our cases are Muslim individuals coming in requiring assistance. So this whole concept that, oh, this is America and there, you know, we have so many programs of food stamps and all of these, but food stamps is just a supplement. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't cover all the costs of groceries and affordable housing crisis that are happening, that people are not able to keep their housing, working 2 jobs. And that affects the mainstream Muslim families as well. We're no different than other ethnicities or other people that are working hard. The majority of our zakah money is actually spent on it. So that should show people that we use these services not to build our offices, but solely on clients for their food, hotel, etc.
Can you talk a little bit about what zakah is?
So zakah money is basically, it's a Muslim has to pay, if you can afford it, if you have the ability, you are to pay every year a certain amount of money towards those who are in need. Because, you know, we have this concept that the money is just not ours. It's something that's given to us by God, and we have to share it, you know, with those who are in need. It's a one-time yearly money that is allocated that we need to give. And people give that, and we use that for our programs.
So I think you gave us a little statistic about maybe 30-40% of the people that you assist are not from the Islamic faith.
Correct, correct.
How do you interact with people from other faiths? Like, what's that interaction? How is that different? And maybe it isn't.
I mean, I have never really thought about it like that, because it's just, regardless of Muslim or non-Muslim, we're still treating people, I wouldn't say equal. You know why? Because everyone has different needs. Mm-hmm. So not just Muslims and non-Muslims. So if a client comes in and they have certain needs, be it a Muslim or non-Muslim, mm-hmm. I will treat them based on what their needs are. So my focus isn't, well, you're not sharing the same faith with me, so therefore I'm going to not help you. Or if you are a different gender or whatever the case, you know, no discrimination. My focus is dealing with each individual based on their needs, their psychological, mental, emotional, financial need, mm-hmm. rather than their creed or their faith or lack of.
So emergency aid is very responsive. Do you do any work beyond that in terms of like addressing some things at the root cause? Like, how do you help families kind of get stable?
At this point, we don't have the scope within our emergency assistance department to do that, because that's another whole department of adding, because you have these emergency services where people have water shut off or they're kicked out of the house, rental issues where they're evicted. So our job is like, okay, one-time help within a six-month period. However, what we do is we work with like different organizations or agencies that do have more resources to connect these clients with. You know, we have a psychologist that we refer our clients to if needed. We have other organizations like Zeka that have transitional shelter, which is so amazing, and they're working on it. ICM and Lutheran Social Services, where we don't have a formal agreement, but an informal, where we're conversing with each other via email or phone when a client comes in. I'm like, okay, this is how much we can do. And then we're able to refer them out. So resources is one of the biggest things, that along with financial assistance that we provide our clients. So they're able to get more help, because affordable housing is a crisis in Minnesota and elsewhere in the U.S. And though homelessness may be going down, if you look at the statistics, there's still a lot of people that are homeless. Our vision is a home for all. So how can we keep this person in a home right now so they can at least try to figure their situation out? Can give them a month or two of relief to look into different things.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes we live in our bubbles and we don't realize like our neighbor's going hungry or they're, you know, facing eviction. How do you tell people about some of the things that are happening through your organization?
Word of mouth is big, because if someone has been helped, some people will be more open to letting their friends know, others don't. And in terms of building blocks, I mean, mashallah, they have been growing and people are knowing about it. So that's another thing. We have it on our website. I do promote it, like Facebook Swap Cities group, where they have like a social worker group. Personally, my caseworkers or I or other people part of building blocks will, when they attend masajid to pray, they'll learn of somebody's situation. So it's really more of word of mouth, along with me connecting with different organizations and letting them know. So apparently United Way 211 has our information. So that's big. Hennepin County tends to refer a lot of their clients to us, different churches and stuff. So that's how officially people who don't need help may know, so they can pass it. But sometimes what I do, which is a little, I don't know if it's sneaky or not, if I'm at a masjid or some gathering, I'll just sort of throw it in there for people, like, you know, subhanAllah, so many people are going through X, Y, and Z, but there's some programs like Muslim organizations or, oh, I'm an emergency assistance coordinator. Like, I don't want to talk too much about myself, but I sometimes throw these things in for people so it can get them thinking if they are in need, and then, or they may just put it in the back of their mind and it may come up later.
So what's the most fulfilling part of this job?
To know that despite coming home and being exhausted, my team and I have made, from, you know, God's permission, we're able to make a difference in somebody's life, to keep them in a home, or that the fact that they were sleeping in a car they didn't eat, mm-hmm. to know that they have food and a shower to take, makes you feel content. I mean, there's so much work to do, no doubt. I'm never fully content. And realistically, I don't think I'll ever be. Because if I am, then I don't think I should be doing this job. But to know that we've made a difference in an individual or family's life means a lot.
What challenges do you face in your program generally?
I signed up for this job about 5 years ago and I was in my teens. And at that time, I'm like, I need some money. Like, hey, I need to buy this like branded jeans. And my dad's like, I'm not buying you $100 jeans, right? So I'm like, okay, I need a job. So I came thinking I'll be here for 3 months. And it ended up being 5 years now. Wow. So, and sort of became my passion. So challenges what I face is obviously running a program with very limited staff. And, you know, another challenging part is turning down people. I'm going to be realistic about it. I'm not going to say, oh, we take 100% of our cases, because we cannot. You know, we get over 80 calls a month between three people. That's a lot of cases to take. So that's a challenging part, is navigating how to help someone if we cannot help them financially, but how we can give them resources that are actually helpful rather than, hey, here you go, a list of resources.
I feel like there's just a lot going on with building blocks and
community building and trying to make a difference. That's not the only thing that you do. You're also a mom, you know, a two-year-old. You do other volunteer work. How do you find the time?
Well, how I find the time is I think I really have a supportive like system that understands that there are things in the community that needs to be done. I think that's one of my biggest things. That's how I find time. Before, I was trying to work with my son at home and I'm like, I can't do that. So my husband and I invested in maybe getting somebody to watch him for a few hours so I can do something. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to. I think it's about finding time and to have a good support system and find ways to invest into getting you to do things. It's important.
We have a lot of sisters who always feel like, you know, I have this and I'm a mom and I work a full-time job and how am I supposed to show up in the community? Like, how do I balance? And then they see women like you who are able to do it and they're trying to figure out how is it. And so what we're learning is that it's hard.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not a Pinterest mom. I think it's about the priority, but I also feel like it's okay if you are a mom and doing a full-time job and you're not able to yet contribute to your community in general. If you cannot invest so much time, it's okay because, you know, Noshina, we all go through different stages in life and we write our own narratives. And until we change those narratives for ourselves, if we are thinking that our children are hindrance into getting things done, you're not really going to enjoy being a parent. So you really have to prioritize and let yourself know it's okay if you can do it right now. But if it's something you want to do, then you have to set goals, make the intentions, pray for it, and find tangible ways of getting there. If this is what's going to satisfy you. But if you're just doing community work because it's something all sisters need to do, then where is the sincerity in it? I feel like you are contributing to your community, even if you're taking care of children, because you are giving your children the education that they need to perhaps go out more than you can to make a difference. So I think we're always doing something, but not in ways that society may expect us to.
So when does Farielle find time for herself?
After my son goes to bed. But when he's sleeping and I find time at night to like do a little bit of reading, I'm really reading some good books right now.
Tell us about your reading materials.
Currently, I'm focusing on sexual education and focusing on erotology. So more about Muslim women and how we deal with sexuality and our sexual intimate lives, which are like, whoa. But I think that's a really big part of our lives. Most of us who choose not to engage in premarital relationships, we're not used to doing anything intimate. And then we go from like not doing anything, no touching and all these things to being in a marital relationship where now everything is a go. My passion, at least, I have so many passions, but this is like a really big passion that's been there for years. And now I'm really trying to work on it is how can I equip Muslim men, and especially women, to enjoy sex?
Whoa, Sister Farielle. This is so much taboo, Sister. Yeah. Where's the modesty in what you're doing right now?
I think the modesty thing that we're putting up, I think it's like this false relationship between what is actually modesty versus what we talk about. Because the Prophet, you know, peace be upon him, has talked about, or, you know, the other companions at the time of the Prophet talked about the women of Ansar who were not shy to learn about their religion. They came and asked him questions about wet dreams, about sexual intercourse. So this is not something new that I'm, you know, starting where I'm like, oh, let's talk about sex today. But if you look at the scholars, Ibn Hazm and other scholars, they have really talked about sexuality and actually that enjoying sex for a man and a woman is part of your spiritual journey. It's not just a physical thing. And I'm currently reading a book called Taste of Honey, but this Nigerian scholar, and he takes it from an Islamic perspective, really about what is sex, what is enjoying sex means. And it's so interesting to read from these past scholars that I've known about, but I've learned about them only from like how much they loved God and how they did their worship. But there's another side to them, which is not at all contradictory to Islam, where it was okay for men and women in a marital relationship to engage in whatever, you know, what's satisfying them. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing taboo about it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it has now become taboo maybe in the past, you know, 80 years or so. But before then, they were open about. For me, it's very important for women to enjoy and be pleased with their sexual life, because I think it is a circle of not just, hey, I'm physically, but I'm emotionally, mentally, and spiritually can benefit from sex. Mm-hmm.
So what's your vision? What are you going to do with reading this, gaining this knowledge? How are you sharing it back with the community?
At this point, I'm just trying to acquaint myself with what I can, because it's important to know the facts from just, you know, speaking about it in manners that are not, you know, true. But what I, God willing, plan to do is, once I get my master's and my degree in marriage family therapy, have more information, have a platform and credibility to talk more. So my vision is to, inshallah, have a curriculum in the Muslim private schools to actually have a sexual education curriculum where they are talking not just about puberty, but they're talking about all the different challenges that our youth are facing in society, whatever it is, you know, homosexuality, transgender issues, any issues that fall within sexuality. I would like people to have a standard curriculum to follow and to know that we need to learn about these things, because if our children are not learning about it from school, they're learning from technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, you give an iPad, you're already exposing them to some sort of pornography. Yeah. And the Sunnah, the Prophet, peace be upon him, was very open to young children learning about, as young as 6 and 7, knowing about what wet dreams are and how you need to clean yourself afterwards. So it's not something that are like, oh, we don't want to talk about these things because somehow talking about them will mean that our children will engage in it. You know, this misconception, which we know by research is not true. There's actually countries that know more about it, or schools that have that curriculum, children are not engaging in as much sex as they would when they're actually informed. The other is going, hopefully, into communities where women do not have this education. They don't know anything about sexual relationships. They don't know anything about their own anatomy. Mm-hmm. I would like to start with like really rural communities, or maybe just starting with workshops on teaching people, not just the biological aspect, your anatomy, which is important too, because a lot of people don't know that, but how to really take that and apply it practically in their life. When I was in Pakistan, my dad's from a rural area, my mom's from a city area. Mm-hmm. The huge difference between education on these topics, it's mind-blowing. A lot of the people I know don't even know anything. They just conceived. And my hopefully plan is to go and help them learn these things and apply them. And once you teach a village there, they're able to teach other people.
Yeah, that's amazing. That sounds like one very much needed conversation and curriculum in our community, but also laced with challenges. Yeah. And you should get ready
for people to give me problems, right? Which is fine, because I know that being a follower of my religion who tends to follow, I know that I'm not doing anything that is not within the realms of my religion, because that's my guiding behavior. Everyone has different guiding morals and values. Mine are my religion, Islam. And within that boundaries, I am very happy and proud to know that we had so much sexual education and knowledge, which we have lost. I remember talking to somebody, a scholar, and I asked him, I'm like, hey, I want to do this. And his response was, hey, this is great. Do it. We need it. But don't expect people to praise you for it, you know, which is fine. Alhamdulillah. I mean, if I know that if I make a difference in the lives of people that I can touch, inshallah, God willing, then I think I'm okay with that. I'm ready.
Well, we know that when leaders step up and they challenge the status quo, they will be faced with challenging opposition, opposing viewpoints, opposing parties. So how do you think you'll prepare yourself to be able to take that opposition on?
Starting with knowledge, I think that's big, right? Because the first word in the Quran is like Iqra, like read, I recite, read. Personally, for me, I would like to be educated on what my rights are and what other people's rights are. So if I'm not taking away anyone's rights by doing my work, that's one thing that's really assuring to me personally, that I'm not doing anything wrong. That's one way to prepare myself, armed with enough knowledge. But knowledge is just technical, right? Practically, what I can do or how I can prepare myself is have a good support system. I am not immune to people and their comments. So I am building a good network. My husband's a great network, great emotional support. My brother, believe it or not, my male members of my family are a support system. Even to this day, we can't fight the battle by ourselves when we don't have 50% of the population involved in it, which are men. So having a good system for myself. And the other aspect is the educational aspect I'm trying to work with to ensure that if I face opposition, how am I going to handle it?
Well, you're clearly a very strong, smart, intelligent woman. Freya, like, who inspires you? What inspires you? Like, what characteristics inspire you to do the work that you're doing?
I don't know if I can call oppression as an inspiration. I don't know if that's wrong, but I think my religion inspires me because I believe when you are given rights by God, I don't think any human has the ability or should have the ability to take them away from you just because they may be men or they may be powerful members of society. But inspiration is there. There's different inspirations, right? I mean, I love words, right? Word porn. Like, I love having words where I'm like, oh my God, these are what inspiring me. My son, my family, being a woman inspires me. Being a munaqaba, one who wears a niqabi, inspires me because we're a minority within a minority. So there are different things, you know, various things that inspire me. So I can't really choose one and say this inspires me. Perhaps my son will inspire me one day and the next day it's like something that happened. But oppression, I would say, is my motivator. If I cannot see women being oppressed, and I feel like God has put me in a position where I'm blessed to have a father who wanted great education for me. I'm blessed to have a husband who encourages me to do what I want. So I feel like I need to give back. And I think I'm doing disservice if I don't, by finding practical ways to get rid of that oppression. Will I be 100% successful? No, but I have to be realistic.
What advice would you give to women today about engaging in their community or leading on topics that are taboo?
What advice? I think it's easy to say, hey, just be yourself. But I think more than that, what I would give advice to youth is hold on to your values, work with them, have a strong foundation, because you will get cracks, you'll get things to be shaking. But whatever that foundation is, if your family is your foundation, your religion is your foundation, believe in your values and go with that. And if it doesn't contradict your values, or for me, it doesn't contradict what my religion has taught me, then to know that what you're doing is okay and you're making a difference, if that can inspire people. Don't let go of your beliefs just because society expects you to. You have to have a strong foundation. Mm-hmm. And that takes time to build. You need to learn yourself. You need to know yourself, appreciate yourself in order to have a structure that's not going to blow away just because two people said something.
I absolutely enjoyed this conversation. You're an amazing individual, Freya. I really wish you a lot of luck in all the work that you're doing. Thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you for having me. And you're an inspiration to everybody to know, Sheena. The great work that you're doing, we really appreciate it in the community. We wish you the best. And I hope that everyone and women in general, we come together to make differences. Thank you.
Thank you to Blue Cross Blue Shield Minnesota for funding the Shiro's Project. To learn more about Shiro's and Reviving Sisterhood, visit us at www.revivingsisterhood.org. Find us on social media at Reviving Sisterhood on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thank you.